Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Job chapter 2. I'm going to call this chapter Satan Destroys Job's Health. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, Satan has destroyed Job's property and family, all of his oxen, all of his donkeys, all of his sheep, all of his camels, and all of his 10 children. Now Satan's going to go after Job's health. Before I start, I need to apologize once again for my voice. I'm in day 4 of COVID, almost over it. I'm hoping you can put up with my voice because I want to continue with this. We start now with Job chapter 2, verse 1 through 3. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil. And he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause." Now notice the again there in verse 1. That's because this is the second meeting of God's heavenly council. It's easy to forget that. There's so much repetition. But chapter 1, we saw the angels of God meeting in council with God. And a lot of the same things were said. And so it's easy to get the two meetings confused. But this is the second one in chapter 2. Now, the day when this second council met, if we knew it, we could determine how long Job's suffering had been going on. A couple of options on that. Adam Clark says he thinks that Job had been suffering for a year because the Jewish Targum indicates that it was at the time of the annual atonement. I don't know how much weight we should give to the Targum. This, of course, would have to assume that Job was written after the Mosaic Law, I suppose, the Day of Atonement, the annual atonement, and that Job would be familiar with that. Well, that's pretty iffy. Job's not a Jew. Why would he know? Why would he care? But another reason Clark gives is that this gives Job a lot of time to manifest his endurance and his long-suffering through his suffering. Well, listen, even if it was 2 weeks later, he's lost everything. He's lost all of his property and all of his family. He's got plenty of time to manifest endurance, even if it's just 2 weeks or a few days after the suffering began. And in fact, John Gill holds to that view. He says this second heavenly council has only taken place about a fortnight at the most past the day of the beginning of the sufferings, because according to Gill's logic, Satan would never give Job such breathing room. He would never leave Job alone for a year without inflicting the further damage of Job's health problems. And not only that, Gill argues, Job's friends wouldn't have stayed away for over a year before they came to comfort him. And I think that latter argument is the positive. So we're going to assume that this heavenly council meets pretty soon after Job's suffering begins. Now, I've mentioned the sons of God before. Almost all the versions, and indeed all the critics, are puzzled with the phrase sons of God, according to Adam Clark. And Clark says expositions are endless. Well, maybe so. But most of the translations, all the versions that I looked at, had the sons of God as angels. John Gill, in fact, says that the phrase sons of God is generally understood to be angels. The NIV has it as angels. Now, the NIV note does say the Hebrew says the sons of God, but they just translate it right there in the text, not in the margin. Angels. Well, I mentioned this in the first chapter, previous audio, but I'll do it again. Why are angels called sons of God? Because sons are like their fathers. They inherit their father's traits. And angels are like God in holiness and knowledge and wisdom. Angels are affectionate towards God, even as a son is affectionate toward his father. Angels are obedient to God, even as a son is obedient to his father. So it's reasonable. It's an understandable phrase. Now, John Gill disagrees with this. He's one of the few. He says that the sons of God are believers in God who meet before God somehow. His argument is this. Nowhere but in the book of Job are angels called the sons of God. Well, that's an argument from silence. That doesn't prove anything. But he has a stronger argument when he says, how could Satan join an assembly of angels? He had been cast down from heaven. Well, my answer to that is, just because he's been cast down, you mean God can't invite him back up for a little powwow? So we're going to take these sons of God as angels meeting with God. Now, this heavenly council is interesting. It's mentioned a lot by people who just love to get into the unseen realm, as the Old Testament scholar Michael Heiser has entitled one of his books. Some people say that it's not even actual, it's a merely figurative counsel. The NIV Study Bible says that this view says the purpose is to show the truth that God is king and all spiritual beings answer to him. Adam Clark agrees with that. He says the scripture speaks of God after the manner of men, for there is a necessity of condescending to our capacities and of suiting the revelation to our apprehension. As kings, therefore, transact their most important affairs in a solemn council or assembly, so God is pleased to represent himself as having his council likewise, and as passing the decrees of his providence in an assembly of his holy angels. Now that, of course, would solve the problem of how the devil could actually be up in heaven at a council, if you just take the thing figuratively. But this is my problem with taking it figuratively, as I mentioned in the last audio. If I have a figure like a metaphor, my love is a red, red rose. Well, the figure is the rose. Well, the rose has to be a figure of something actual. It has to point to something objectively real and concrete. So if this is figurative, what's it pointing to? What is the figure pointing to? You've got a council of angels standing around God. Well, then what is it pointing to? What is the reality behind it? So I just take it as an actual heavenly council. And if you read Heiser's books, and I'm in the process, you will see that angels do a lot of stuff carrying out God's work on earth. I don't know why he chose to do it that way. Of course, he's God. He could have done it directly, but he liked to do it through angels. So he does a lot of governance in the world through angels. So we now need to look at why did the angels present themselves to God? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speculate that they were there to render account of their ministry in other parts of the universe. We read in Hebrews 1:14, are they, angels, not all ministering spirits sent out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation? So angels are all over the universe doing work for those who are going to be in the elect, both Old and New Testament. And so the idea here is, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, is that they come back from doing that work and reported to God, yeah, we set things up. We got a lot of people getting saved here. We got some people getting saved there. That's interesting. Why did Satan come up to this council? Well, he was either commanded to come by God or he came as an intruder to accuse Job. I don't think he came as an intruder. I think God could have kicked him out very easily. I think the rest of the angels probably could have kicked him out. I suspect he was commanded to come up there by God because God had some work he wanted to use the devil to do. God uses the devil to work his purposes. The devil is stupid enough to do exactly what God tells him to do because he is totally evil and he doesn't care that he knows he's going to lose in the end anyway. He just likes doing the evil in the process. Or maybe he's too stupid to realize that his evil is not going to prevail. I'm not sure which. But at any rate, I believe he was commanded to come up to that angel by God. And when God asked him what he's been up to, Satan says, I've been roaming about the world, roaming about on the earth and walking around on it. Well, that seems like sort of an innocuous answer. I've just been walking around. That doesn't make any sense, actually. Satan was probably roaming with a purpose. 1 Peter 5:8, be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. That's probably what he was doing, roaming around on the earth looking for someone to devour. We should notice here, as a little sidelight, that the devil cannot just devour anyone he wants. He's got to go looking for someone he can devour. He's got to go looking for a victim. Now, there's two kinds of victims to the devil. First kind are those who have opened themselves up to the devil with their sin, their witchcraft, their occult practices, their adultery, their homosexuality, whatever it is, their materialism, their selfishness, their greed. But the other kind of victims are those whom God has allowed Satan to test. And as we've seen in the last chapter, and we'll see in this chapter, Job was a righteous man. And so it wasn't because of sin that the devil came after him. It's because God allowed it to test him, to bring Job up to a higher level of love and trust in his heavenly Father. And, of course, that's the great application point for all of us today because all of us suffer. We live in a world of suffering, and we've got to endure it and overcome it and get closer to God in the process. Now, in verse 3, God tells Satan, there is no one like him on the earth, blameless and upright, fearing God, turning away from evil. So God's saying, okay, you want a good target? Try Job. You think you're so good at devouring people? Let's see if you can get Job. He holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin me without cause. And of course, now remember, at this point, Job has already lost all of his property and all of his family, suffering that most of us will never have to endure, hopefully. But still, he's held his integrity. And so God is kind of taunting Satan, says, yeah, you're such a tempter, aren't you? You like to bring people to evil and destruction, don't you? But Job's still standing. Now, Satan perhaps had said he'd been roaming around on the earth. He could have been kind of proud about it. He could have been talking in a swaggering manner, as John Gill says, as if he were prince of the world, walking around surveying his dominions, as if he had full liberty to go where he pleased, as if he were sovereign over the earth. Oh, no, he's not sovereign, because there's still a guy down there named Job who still hasn't sinned yet. Now, when God tells Satan, have you considered my servant Job? No one like him on earth, blameless and upright. He's just repeating exactly what he told Satan at the first heavenly council. And then God said that you, Satan, have incited me against Job. You've incited me against Job to ruin him without cause. Now, that raises a small theological problem. Can you perhaps say that Satan has made God do something that God doesn't want to do? Well, of course not. God's omniscient. But what he's saying is that Satan is urging God to do something that Satan wants him to do, but it doesn't mean that God has to do it. God allowed it because he had a purpose behind it. He wasn't forced to do something against his will. The author of this text here is using human language to explain supernatural happenings. Incited. As a matter of fact, it was God that first pointed out Job to Satan. Job 1:8, the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? He said, oh, you're up here in the council? Look, here's Job. Let's see what you can do with him. So it's not like God didn't want to do this. It's not like God didn't want this to happen to Job. He did, but he had a higher purpose. Other translations of that word, incite, God's word has it, you're trying to provoke me, Satan. Some translations have a form of the word move. You have moved me against Job. Bible in Basic English, American Standard Version, KJV, Young's Little Translation. Some translations have a form of incite, just like here. The version I'm using here is the NASB, but also the Holman Christian Study Bible has incite. The New American Bible has incite. So it doesn't matter. God, Satan is pushing on God to get him to do something Satan wants, but God doesn't have to do it. He just allows it because he wants to, because he has a higher purpose. Now we go to Job 2, verses 4 through 5. Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He will curse you to your face. Now let's look at this proverb, skin for skin. You know, like all proverbs, they're a little bit hard to interpret. I heard one the other day, keep your pants on. Where did that come from? Keep your pants on? What does that mean? If you try to literally interpret proverbs, I learned this by studying Chinese. They have all these proverbs, and I don't have a foggiest clue what they mean. And they just look at you and say, well, that's an idiom. In other words, forget it. Don't try to translate it. You will not understand, foreigner. Well, let's look at the meaning of the proverb. Satan is maintaining his original point, he's saying. As he said in Job 1:11, stretch out your hand and strike everything he owns, and he will surely curse you to your face. In other words, what he's saying is, God, Job is worshiping you for mere mercenary motives. He's faithful to you because he still has his possessions. Take his possessions away and he won't worship you. And now he's saying here in the second council, take his health away. He's worshiping you because he still has his health. Take his health away and he'll curse you. Now, John Gill takes a stab at this, the proverbs, meaning he's saying he hasn't gotten down to the point, Job, yet, where he only has his skin to save his skin, to save his life. In other words, strip him down to his skin and let's see if Job will worship you then. That's a little fuzzy to me. So let's look at some explanations of the proverb as people have attempted to do. First one, the skin of the hand will be given to shield the skin of the head or eye. In other words, I'll give up some skin to save the most important skin. I'll give up some unimportant skin to save my most important skin, to save my life. Option number two, skin of others will be given to save one's own skin. Like Job's children and his servants. Yes, he gives up all of his other people's skin to save his own life. People will do that. His third option, the skins of animals used for food and sacrifice will be given for one's own skin. So the devil's saying, the skin of your sacrificial animals and your food animals are given to save his life. He's already given all that up, but he's still living. because he wants to save his life. That's all that matters to him. He don't want to worship you. He just wants to save his life. So he gives up all the skin of his animals. That's option number three. Option number four. Skin refers to, the first skin is refers to money made out of leather that will be given for one's life. So Satan is saying he'll pay anything to stay alive because that's all that's important to him is staying alive, not worshiping you, God. So leather money for skin. Well, I don't believe that's it, but that's an option. Option number five, one will give his outer skin in order to save his inner skin. This assumes the skin has two layers, of course. That might be medically suspect. I'm sure it is. But the idea is a man will give everything he's got, even his outer skin, to save his inner skin so he can stay alive. In other words, his life is more important to him than anything, including worshiping you, God. Option number six, a man will give one member up in order to save the rest of his members. In other words, the skin of my hand, chop it off so the skin of my body will continue on. I give everything up. I'll even give my hand up to save my life because my life's more important than worshiping God. Jameson, Fussett, and Brown sort of summarize, and they say, the first skin is metaphorical for any outward good. In other words, you give anything, whatever the skin is. I've given you lots of options, but whatever it is, a man will give it away to save his life because that's the most important thing to him. Job still has his life, so he hasn't proven to you that he'll die for you, God. He hasn't been reduced to the depths of despair, to the depths of degradation. Put him down even lower. Let's see if he'll curse you in order to save his life. So let me see if I can kind of summarize all this. One way you can look at it is saying this. Look, Satan is saying this. Job has lost all of his outward possessions. He only has his skin left to give for his life. Job hasn't cursed you yet, but you take away more than his outward possessions, you get him down to his skin, he will curse you. Or it could be Job hasn't gotten to the point where he's lost a part of his own body yet. He's lost his own possessions, but he still has his body, and his body's still alive. Let's see if you can take some of his body away from him and see if he will refrain from cursing you. Now notice Satan tells God that Job will curse you face to face if he's put in that extreme position of loss. As I said earlier, that's exactly the same thing that Satan said at the first heavenly council. Job 1:11, but stretch out your hand and strike everything he owns, and he will surely curse you to your face. Well, guess what? Satan was wrong about that charge in the first council because God did allow Satan to take everything that Job owned, and he did not curse God face to face because in the second heavenly council, God repeats, Job is righteous in everything that he does. So Satan was wrong at the first heavenly council, and we're going to see later he's wrong at the second heavenly council. Job will not curse God face to face. We go now to Job 2, verses 6 through 8. So the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your power. Only spare his life. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And Job took a potsherd to scrape himself while he was sitting among the ashes. Now in verse 6, when God says, Job is in your power, only spare his life. He's talking about Job's physical life. Obviously not talking his spiritual life there. So now Job was smitten by Satan with sore boils. Now Job's actual disease is not known, of course. These ancient diseases are not known today. But here is a list of his symptoms collated from the whole book. Job was disfigured in chapter 2, verse 12. He had parasites in chapter 7, verse 5. He had skin infections in chapter 7, verse 5. He had hallucinations in chapter 7, verse 14. He was emaciated in chapter 19 and 20. He had sharp pains in chapter 30, verse 17. He had a fever in chapter 30. When I think about the mild symptoms I had with COVID-19 compared with Job, I don't feel sorry for myself. In fact, I feel sort of elated just to be able to live in a normal way compared to what this man went through. The NIV translates boils as sores. The NIV Study Bible says they may have been boils, painful bacterial infections of the skin. Some speculate it was leprosy, forcing him to sit outside the house. Now, Adam Clark, who was a 19th century wannabe doctor, he was a polymath, he knew everything, second only to God. Quote, from Clark, in the elephantiasis, and leprosy there is, properly speaking, no boil or detached inflammation or swelling, but one uniform disordered state of the whole surface. so that the whole body is covered with loathsome scales, and the skin appears like that of an elephant, thick and wrinkled, from which appearance the disorder has its name. Elephantiasis is a form of leprosy, as Jameson Forsyth Brown says. Now, these are old doctors. They might be wrong, medically speaking. Now, I don't know. I just like to read these speculations about how bad Job had it. Adam Clark said it was smallpox. Quote, in the smallpox, it is different. Each pock or pustule is a separate inflammation tending to suppuration. And during this process, the fever is in general very high, and the anguish and distress of the patient intolerable. When the suppuration is pretty far advanced, the itching is extreme, and the hands are often obliged to be confined to prevent the patient from literally tearing his own flesh. And John Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown come up with this gruesome speculation because the Hebrew word for boils is singular, suggesting that Job was covered with boils so that it was like he had one big boil. Now, Job in verse 8 had to use a broken piece of pottery, potsherd, I think is how you pronounce that, to scrape himself, but he didn't curse God. He didn't even complain, as John Gill says. He just scratched. Why? To relieve the itching, to remove pus from the boils. John Gill has another great elaboration of the scene as he observes it in his mind. Quote, Job's maids and his servants and even his wife stood at some distance from him. The smell of him might be so nauseous that it was intolerable. He was obliged to do what was done himself. In other words, he had to scrape himself because his wife couldn't even get close enough to him because he smelled too bad so that she could scrape. And then, of course, now in verse 8, we see that Job is sitting among ashes. That's a typical posture of someone who is in extreme grief. We go now to Job chapter 2, verses 9 through 10. Then Job's wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. That's one of the most shocking statements of anyone I read about in the Bible. Curse God? Are you crazy, woman? But that's what she said. But Job said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity? And all this Job did not sin with his lips. Now, the Septuagint adds some stuff here. I don't know where the Septuagint gets all this extra stuff, but let me quote it. It's in King James English because I got it from Adam Clark. Much time having elapsed, Job's wife said unto him, how long dost thou stand steadfast, saying, behold, I wait yet a little longer, looking for the hope of my salvation. Behold, thy memorial is already blotted out from the earth, together with thy sons and thy daughters. What she's saying here is that nobody's going to remember you, Job. Your kids are all gone. You're going to die, and that's the end of you. Together with thy sons and thy daughters, the fruits of my pains and labors, for whom with anxiety I have labored in vain. Thyself also sittest in the rottenness of worms night and day, while I am a wanderer from place to place and from house to house, waiting for the setting of the sun that I may rest from my labors and from the griefs which oppress me. Speak therefore some word against God and die. Well, that just adds to the dramatic scene. It doesn't change the meaning. It's interesting. Now remember, to this wife's credit, or to maybe ameliorate some of our scorn toward her, she had lost her property and children as well as Job, and she was about to lose her husband, I'm sure she thought. So it's sort of understandable that she didn't have the quote-unquote patience of Job, the quote-unquote endurance of Job. She didn't have it, and it's understandable. But it was still terrible for Job's wife to be talking like this. Imagine if you were Job, you've married a wife, she's supposed to be your helpmeet, she's supposed to be your helper, your comfort, and instead of getting help and comfort from her, all he got was abuse. You're trusting in God, there's no God. Or if he's a God, he's an evil God, doesn't care about you. Curse him and say goodbye, get out of here, die. You're not going to live, and I'm not going to live either, I'm sure is what she's thinking. Now she said, hold fast your integrity. What does she mean by Job's integrity? That means Job's belief in God. Hold fast your belief in God, you still do that? Oh, come on, Job. I wonder, does the wife believe that Job has committed a secret sin, like we'll see later Job's false friends believe, that he's committed some kind of sin that God is punishing him for? Now, Job had already held fast his integrity after losing his property and children after his first test, chapter 1. Job 2:3 says this, the Lord said to Satan, if you consider my servant Job, there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil, and he still holds fast his integrity. Now in verse 9, when the wife says, curse God and die, what does she mean by curse God and die? Here's an option Gill suggests. She's saying, curse God and then go kill yourself, Job. Or curse God to provoke him so God will kill you. Suicide by God. Another option by Gill. Third option, curse God and then be put to death by the civil authorities for blasphemy. Oh, come on. I don't believe that's true. What civil authorities that believe in Yahweh out there in the middle of the desert, the land of Uz? Here's another option. The word that's used for curse can also be translated as bless, which I think is interesting. Gill and Clark say that the Hebrew word means both curse and bless. Bless God and die. Well, that will make Job's wife look a lot better. She would have given up on Job's earthly life, but she wouldn't have given up on God. But the problem, if you translate it that way, is that the very next verse, Job calls his wife a fool. Why would God do that if his wife said something as nice as, bless God and die? Well, she could have been sarcastically saying, bless God on your way out, you fool. Sarcastically, well, that's the same thing as saying curse God. Well, and besides, even if you do take it that way, either way, Job's wife had given up on God. Now, Job says in verse 10, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Now, when we think fool, we think intellectually deficient, but the language doesn't quite translate that way because the Hebrew word foolish denotes moral deficiency as opposed to intellectual deficiency. So he's basically saying, you are morally deficient, wife. We need to accept good from God, and we need to accept adversity from God because God's in charge. Now, note the obvious implication is that the adversity came from God. Now, that's true, at least indirectly. Satan didn't put those boils on Job's body. Excuse me. God did not put those boils on Job's body. Satan did, but God allowed it. So it was true indirectly that the adversity came from God. And Job did not sin when he said this. Apparently, the name it and claim it, blab it and grab it, scream it and redeem it, mark it and park it, confess it and possess it, folks, can't read the last part of the verse. The last part of the verse says, in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He said, we must accept adversity from God. Have you ever heard Kenneth Copeland say that? Or Cashflow Dollar? Or Joel Osteen? We need to accept adversity from God. And when Job said that, he did not sin with his lips. Explain that to me, Kenneth Copeland. No, I don't want to listen to you. I don't even want to listen to you try to explain it, because you don't care. NIV Study Bible says, Job concluded that trouble from God was better than comfort and ease without God. Ain't that the truth? We go now to Job 2, 11 through 13, and we'll finish up with this chapter. Now when Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard all about this adversity that had happened to him, each of them came from his home. They met together to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they looked from a distance, they could barely recognize him. They wept aloud, and each man tore his robe and threw dust into the air and on his head. Then they sat on the ground with him 7 days and nights, but no one spoke a word to him because they saw that his suffering was very intense. Now Eliphaz, where is he from? From Teman. Teman, T-E-M-A-N, is the only one of the three places that these three friends came from that can be identified with certainty, as the NIV Study Bible says. It was an Edomite city south of the Dead Sea. It was considered a center of wisdom at the time. Jeremiah 49:7 says this, concerning Edom, thus says the Lord of hosts, is there no longer any wisdom in Teman? Has good counsel been lost to the prudent? Has their wisdom decayed? In other words, Teman is used as a well-understood proverb for wisdom. Kind of interesting. Well, unfortunately, the Temanite's representative, Eliphaz, was not wise in this situation when he and his buddies come to advise Job, as we'll see later. The second guy is Bildad the Shuhite. I remember the question, who's the shortest man in the Bible, Bildad the Shuhite, because he's only the height of a shoe? Ha ha ha. Well, this Shuhite, this Bildad, may have descended from the eastern tribe of Shua, as the NIV Study Bible says. Shua was Abraham's youngest son, Genesis 25:2. She, referring to Abraham's wife Keturah, not Sarah now, but Keturah. Keturah bore to Abraham Zimram and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and Ishbak and Shua. The NIV Study Bible says further about Shua. Little is known about the Shuhite tribe. Abraham and his concubine Keturah had a son named Shua. Shua and his brothers went to the land of the east. We read that in Genesis 25:6, which I'll read in a minute. Bildad was likely from this area, which carried the original settler's name. Genesis 25:6 says this, "And Abraham gave gifts to the sons of his concubines, but while he was still alive, he sent them eastward, away from his son Isaac, to the land of the east." I didn't know that Keturah was a concubine. I thought she was a wife, but I'll let that one go, because this is a relatively minor point. And then the last friend of Job was Zophar the Naamathite. Now, this word Naamathite or Naamath occurs nowhere else in the Bible, as the NIV Study Bible says. Some say it is in Arabia. Well, nobody knows where it is. But at any rate, these are desert dwellers that are friends of Job, and they come and they see him from a distance. It says in verse 12, they looked from a distance. They could barely recognize him. Why were they looking at him from a distance? Or how could they look at him from a distance? Job was either inside of his house or out. If he was inside of his house, how could they look at him from a distance? Well, if he is inside the house, scraping his boils, he's at the farther part of the room where he cannot be seen easily. And so they're looking at him, peering through the darkness, the interior darkness. But of course, if he's outside the house, which he very well could be, he could have a leprous-type skin condition. Nobody wanted him in the house if he smelled so bad. He might have been outside in the dust, scraping himself, and the friends saw him from a distance from the outside. Either way, they could barely recognize him. This proud, regal Bedouin, this king of the desert, was now reduced to utter misery. The three friends wept aloud, each man tearing his robe and throwing dust in his hair and his head, traditional signs of mourning. And then they sat on the ground with Job for 7 days and seven nights, not speaking a word to him. Why? That's a long time. Why did they take so long to not speak? Well, perhaps it shows that Job's friends were especially good friends. They wanted to be with him. Now, that's not as 7 days is not as long as it would be in our culture. Life back then was a lot slower paced, as the NIV Study Bible astutely remarks. But still, 7 days. John Gill says, as the 7 days passed, Job's pain probably grew worse. And also we need to note that they sat with him for 7 days. I pictured this. They just sat there for 7 days. No, that was for most of each day and night, as Jameson Fawcett and Brown says. After all, they had to get up to eat. They had to go to the bathroom. The reason they sat next to Job for 7 days and seven nights, or at least a speculated reason that the friends sat with Job for 7 days and seven nights, is that 7 days was the customary period for a mourning fast. Genesis 50:10, when they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and sorrowful lamentation, and he observed 7 days mourning for his, Joseph's father. This is Joseph's father, Jacob. This was when Joseph had leave from the Pharaoh to go bury his father, Jacob, in the Promised Land. And he did, and when he did, Joseph observed 7 days mourning for his father, Jacob. Traditional mourning period. 1 Samuel 31:13. That's referring to the Jabesh Gileadites, who were right across the Jordan River from Bethshan, where Saul and Jonathan got killed in their last battle with the Philistines. And the Jabesh Gileadites took Saul and Jonathan's bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. So we can deduce from that this 7 days was probably a time of fasting also. Now, I don't know. I've never fasted 7 days for anybody, myself, much less for a friend. I can't imagine fasting 7 days. If this means going 7 days without eating, could be you go one day and fast and then eat at night. I mean, you could take it that way. I don't know how they did fast back then. But at any rate, they were really trying to show comfort to him. Let me point out here that we can infer from the 7 days that these three friends of Job were fasting for him. It's not stated in the text, but it could be reasonably inferred. Now, the next question is why did not anybody speak to Job? Here's some options suggested by Gill. Number one, the friends were suspicious Job had caused his misery by his sin, and they didn't want to say so. Too embarrassed. That is kind of touchy. Hey, you're sick because you're a sinner. Pharisees used to believe that. Option number two, suggested by Gill, the friends were stricken by grief and they just couldn't speak. Option number three, suggested by Gil. The friends did not know what comfort they could administer because Job was so sunk in grief. Option number four, the friends were astounded that such a wealthy man could have such a reversal in fortune. Well, I think it's probably all four of those things. They thought Job had sinned. They weren't going to say anything. They were grief-stricken by what happened. They didn't know how they could comfort a guy. I never know how to comfort people in misery. I'm not a good counselor. I can see why they would have trouble with that, and I can see how they would be just awestruck that such a wealthy man could have such bad things happen to him in such a short period of time. Now, a couple of minor points in this section, and we'll be finished with the chapter. First, concerning the dust that was thrown into the air by the three friends as they were mourning. They threw the dust in the air with the intention that the ashes would fall on their heads, not that the wind would blow it away. Why? This was a sign of intense mourning, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. We see some examples of this in other places. For example, in Acts 22:23, and they were crying out and throwing off their cloaks, the Jews were, and tossing dust into the air. These were the unbelieving Jews upset with the Apostle Paul at the end of his third journey when Paul went back to Jerusalem and tried to tell him he had been speaking to those nasty, dirty dog Gentiles. That's something to get really mournful about and throw dust up in the air. And then in verse 13, the three friends sat on the ground. That's also a sign of mourning. We see in Lamentations 2:10, the elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground. They are silent. The daughter of Zion is the population of Jerusalem. The reason they're silent is because the Babylonians in 586 came down and burnt down their city, and as a result, they sat on the ground. And then they've all thrown dust on their head, another example of dust on their heads. And then they've girded themselves with sackcloth, another expression of grief. Ladies and gentlemen, on that sad note, we have finished with Job chapter 2. We are now prepared to turn to Job chapter 3, verses 1 through 26, and we will see Job starting to complain. He hasn't cursed God. He will never curse God. But, oh boy, does he complain. Not that I blame him. I'd be complaining, too. I complain over a lot less stuff than Job did. We'll call next chapter Job Laments the Day He Was Born. I hope you stay tuned for that lament, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.